Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Oil making new highs to 105 and backing off a little, 8.9% on the unemployment rate, but the labor participation rate is in question. And what are the technical indicators for this market? We're going to have Jeff Rosen from Briefing.com as a guest, and we're going to have Corey Rosenblum from Afraid to Trade. All this and much more on episode 202 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, thanks for joining me today. This is Andrew Horowitz. And boy, it's been a very volatile and a very exciting week, to say the least, right? I mean, there's been goings on around the world that we haven't seen in a long time. But even with all that, we got to admit, the stock market in the U.S. and for most of the world has been, well, rather resilient. And a lot of that has to do with some of the things that are in play right now, like, well, QE2 and corporate earnings. So there's good news out there. The economics are looking good and better as they come out each and every time. So we're going to get into that discussion with our two guests today. Before I do that, though, I want to just mention two things. First of all, I did this last year, and I hope you can help out. This is really important to me. You know, my birthday month is March, and I last year I asked all of you to do me a favor, and that was if you like the show. I never ask you to pay for anything and all that to support the show very much here or there, and we try to do it by advertising. Of course, you know that you can come to us for money management and all that, but as a special gift, if you will, I was hoping maybe you can help support a really good cause. I'm on the committee to help out the Jason Taylor Reading Room, and this is a special program for underprivileged kids down in Miami, and they have a place to go. They learn reading and all sorts of other things in a really safe environment. Jason Taylor, if you know, he was on the Miami Dolphins. He went to the Jets, recently released from the New York Jets. A good player, great player, actually. And he's a friend. His office is actually in eyesight for the foundations and eyesight from my office. And I got to tell you something. I've seen firsthand the good that this does. So what I'm going to do is, for the next few episodes, is have a link on the show notes for each and every episode where you can simply give $25 or $50. And I really do encourage you to do so. It's really important just to give back. It's always important to give back. And if you could do so, you could do it right through PayPal, through your credit card. And if you've enjoyed some of the things we've talked about on the show, that would be a great thing, and it'd be a great birthday present for me, and it's a way that we could all really channel some of our hopeful successes that we've had and some of our charitable intentions to a really wonderful, wonderful cause. So just hop on that, go over to the Jason Taylor link that's on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you know what? I know a lot of people, we'll do it later. Do that right now. Please go ahead. I mean, I don't want to sound like a telethon, but roll the timpanis. But if you could do that, that would really be special, and I would really, really appreciate it. The other thing I want to mention to you is that I spent the weekend with a really special program. Investors Business Daily has a series of home study courses as well as live courses that they give. And there was one actually in Miami, and I thought that I'd spend some time down there looking at that. I also was able to, over the last several months, do the home study courses, the 1, 2, and 3. I really wanted to see if this was something that could be beneficial to my listeners here, obviously. And everybody's always looking for some education, I thought. So I went down and I checked it out. What a marvelous program. I mean, just an absolutely intense day from 8 to 5 of understanding the fundamentals of a stock in the markets and the psychology of it, as well as when to buy, when to sell, what to look at, what are the key points, what are buy points and sell points, et cetera. And I got to tell you, I encourage you, if you haven't done so, either to check out one of the live courses, and the home study courses are just absolutely fabulous. They come with CDs and books, and man, they are very, color charts in the books where you can mark them up and you can follow along with what they're talking about. Neat stuff. But the other thing is that I spent some time with Scott O'Neill from Investor's Business Daily. We spent a lot of time together after the program and had some dinner. What a great guy. I mean, just a great guy. And he's in charge of one of the things he does is the MarketSmith product. Now, let me tell you something. For a long time, we had been using, for example, screeners over at MSN that we told you to use, the Microsoft screener, Microsoft Money. And, you know, there was a kind of a vacuum of screeners that were available or lack of screeners that were available when Microsoft took their screener offline. Google does a little one. You can do one at FinViz that we like. And those are free. The MarketSmith product has an unbelievable screener in there where you can look up all sorts of criteria to filter the quantitative part of your research, to filter stocks on all sorts of different criteria. And what's nice is they have a lot of pre-built ones as well. Now, on top of that, the product will allow you to look back in time and test out. So, for example, you can look at a chart and say, I would have bought here. Let's say you positioned it 2 years ago, and you don't see the right side of the chart. You keep it kind of empty. And then you can kind of go through and see the progression to see how you did. Was this a right buy point? Was I looking at the information correctly? And this is something I got to tell you. So this is what you do. I think it's, I may be talking out of school here, but I think it's $19.95 for a two-week trial, I think. I think it is. Anyway, go over to MarketSmith. Check this out. I think it's $19.95. You get some coaching. And if you're looking for a really nice chart system, not like the advanced charting of, let's say, TradeStation, or maybe even some of the stuff that you'll see on stock charts. But if you want a chart and fundamental analysis and quantitative screening process all in one, this is cherry. These guys put an unbelievable amount of time in this. And again, just a couple things I want to bring to you because everybody always is asking me. I get emails all the time. You know, what is the best things to use? What tools am I using, et cetera? This is something I use it, by the way. I use Bloomberg. I use that. TradeStation is probably about 7 or 8 different briefing.com we use. I mean, 7 or 8 different things that we use here in my office. But this is something that you really should check out. Go, it's over at MarketSmith.com. I highly encourage you to do so. So, you know, with that, I think that you'll have a great package. And if you can give to the Jason Taylor Foundation as a birthday present, maybe. I don't know. Kind of creepy asking for a birthday present. But it is charity, right? I'd appreciate that. So let's get into what we want to talk about today. So first up, we're going to have Jeff Rosen. He's an economist over at briefing.com, and we spent some time talking over, the last couple of years. By the way, folks, if you haven't checked out what briefing.com has to offer, you really need to do so because they have teams of people that are just basically crunching data, spitting it out, and providing you with all the insight. So I do encourage you to do so. But you know, today we're talking all about levels of interest for the markets with Corey Rosenbloom. And I want to talk, first of all, with Jeff about the impact on economics when it comes to the oil situation and the Middle East. So here we go. Jeff, that was the intro, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. Everything good with you, by the way? Everything well with the economy world, the world of economy and economizing, and et cetera?
Yeah, everything seems to be moving steadily upward, so it's a fairly easy task right now.
So we'll get to that in a second, because it does seem almost Christmas in the U.S. economy and the world economy right now. But let's talk about oil. Oil, you know, eclipsing 104, and who knows where it's going, but let's just talk about oil above 100. There's been a lot of talk about that affecting the potential for the corporate profits and spending by consumers. What's your take on that?
It's not really oil at 100, oil at 150. It's the move between, you know, where we were in January versus where we are today, or where we are today versus where we're going to be in 6 months. Essentially, the way we model the economy, oil doesn't play a significant role. I mean, for every $10 increase in oil price on average for the year, we're only seeing a reduction in GDP by about 0.1 percentage point. But the psychological impact on how consumers change their allocation of their consumption bundle has a direct impact on how firms are going to be profitable, you know, through the end of 2011.
Right. But when it comes to, you know, I think there's, when we look at bonds, and I don't know if you ever looked at a couple different indicators. When you do things like look at skew, and you look at a calculation to see what would be the change in the price of bond
of a bond when you look at the change in the underlying interest rate at a certain velocity, right? So we talk about the skew.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're talking about. You're saying that it's not the fact that we've gone from, you know, 75 or whatever the number is to 104. It's just this compact time of 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. And that's what's really going to be more problematic or have more important impact.
We'll have a more important impact in the immediate term. You know, if we stay at this level for the rest of the year, the impact will already be felt. And we'll just see, you know, reallocation what consumers spend their money on. So, you know, at $100 oil, we have, you know, in Chicago, we have $3.70 gasoline. So we're obviously going to be spending more money on imported oil to pay for the gasoline and maybe a little less money on, you know, clothing or some other, you know, discretionary spending, non-staple good. And that's really what you have to look for, is see where the move comes. So in the economy itself, it's not really that big of a deal.
Right. So, but what about where we saw the payroll numbers come out on Friday, and we saw that it was a bit above expectations, although admittedly, I think the market was expecting a lot more. And one of the components, though, when we look at that was wage increases. And that was, did you see that? If you look at it on a chart, we had this kind of drop off on wages. Does that cause you any kind of concern at all when we factor in also higher cost of gasoline?
Well, when we were modeling for 2011, we took it as that wage growth was going to be concurrent with payroll growth. Mm-hmm. And we obviously saw today that wages for the year only increased 1.7%, and CPI for the year only increased 1.6%. So if you do the math, you can see that, you know, wages, you know, has not moved at all from where we were last year. So looking at that, consumption growth on the surface would be stunted. However, when you're increasing payrolls by 150,000, 130,000, if you take the average over the last few months, the aggregate amount of income has increased because there's just more people getting that income, and that will drive consumption forward. It just might not be as strong as we would have hoped if you were adding more people along with increasing the wages of the people that already had jobs.
All right, so one of the things that has been, I guess, a lot of people have been wondering about is the idea of inflation, because there seems to be different ideas depend on who you talk to, and it's very befitting of what their particular, well, I don't want to say outlook, but their particular needs are. For example, Ben Bernanke says that inflation that they're looking at for the U.S. markets are what they consider core. They'll eliminate the energy and food pricing. On the other hand, Trichet over in Europe says, hey, you know what? You got to include all of that, and we're thinking about actually increasing the rates over time. Now, obviously, one of the things that Trichet has been trying to do is prop up the euro, because obviously there was a lot of scuttlebutt about the euro failing. On the other hand, we see that Bernanke is doing his best to basically extinct the dollar in an effort to create demand through inflation, et cetera. Now, which one's right?
Well, I mean, each sector, each, you know, United States versus Europe, I mean, they're doing things differently based on their own needs. I mean, that's the first of all. In terms of inflation fighting by putting in oil prices and food prices, it's not a very, best way of putting this, it's not a very good method of forecasting forward by looking at the headline rate, meaning that when you have all this volatility, if you take the headline rate today and you try to project it out 12 months from now, the odds that you hit it are very, very slim. Meanwhile, if you take the core rate and you project it out expecting that's going to be what the headline rate is in 12 months from now, it's a much more accurate reading. So when Trichet is trying to, you know, cut inflation down by looking at a short-term spike in one commodity that seems to have generated at least a sizable move in their headline numbers, they have the strong risk of increasing rates too fast for what inflation is going to be in a year from now. And in that rate, you know, they may have screwed up, you know, in my language, where their economy should be, and have taken away potential growth, where Bernanke, you know, especially at this point, you know, the recovery still being, you know, in its early stages, you know, doesn't want to do that. And I'm leaned more towards the way Bernanke is feeling. Now, you know, the dollar versus the euro, you know, weakening the dollar, strengthening the euro, reality is I don't see how it makes too much of a difference for, you know, what we want. I mean, in terms of the economy, we want more jobs. We want to increase our exports. We want to get the export sector is moving as fast as possible. It's better to have a weaker dollar. If Bernanke's goal is that, you know, he doesn't state it specifically, but it seems to be a you know, a positive for what the economy wants.
Yeah, well, you and I talked about that. I thought that the whole Bernanke game was not really overtly about the things that he talked about, although those would possibly be the end result, that there was a bit more, and I wrote about this, kind of a magic trick that he was pulling, kind of a, you know, where he was looking to say that, and for political correctness, that, hey, we want to create jobs and, you know, we want to keep inflation up, et cetera. But yet at the same time, he really wanted to do things that he could, you know, stoke it through lowering the dollar down, et cetera. But you didn't exactly see eye to eye on me in that. And we'll see if that eventually works out in the future. But when you look at the net result of what has happened, two things that I think we could both agree with, although Bernanke says it's not, the moves that he has done, whatever the end product is, it has created a tremendous move on commodity prices. Would you agree with that?
I don't know if it's necessarily what Bernanke has done in the effect that, you know, he has driven up commodity prices by weakening the dollar. I think more likely that the explanation is that you had global demand has increased so much for commodities because a lot of these countries are importing our monetary policy. And because of that, there, you know, you're having growth in many developing countries that are moving much, much faster than you know, than they normally would, and are on the verge of overheating.
So does the combination, though, do you think, of a weaker dollar, the demand, and now, well, let's take those things. The weaker dollar and demand, then, put them together, does create higher oil prices and commodity prices, energy prices, et cetera. At least we know that from a demand side, yes, and the dollar being weaker doesn't help the situation either, right?
I don't think it helps or hurts it. I mean, it's simply the fact that demand in China for oil is moving up at an exponential rate, and as long as they continue to need more commodities and more oil, prices of oil are still going to rise. As long as the U.S. is, you know, expanding, we're going to need more oil. So now we have U.S. needing more oil, China needing more oil, demand is up, supply is, you know, constrained because you have problems in North Africa and in the Middle East, you should have prices rise.
Okay, and then you add the last point that you said, that last component of, you know, North Africa, Middle East, and all that, and the recipe is frankly kind of scary, don't you think?
Well, it's scary to a point. I mean, eventually prices are going to get so high that they're going to price consumers out, meaning that, you know, we're going to not drive as much, we're going to use more public transportation, we're going to be, you know, using less gasoline, using less oil, supply or demand falls, supply remains somewhat constrained,
right.
But at the same time,
right.
You know, we should see prices fall.
Yeah, no, I hear
and
you.
If
I mean,
you look at the, I'm sorry.
No, all I was going to say was that, you know, if you look at the situation, obviously, you know, there's a certain point that's the end of it. You know, that if it gets to $1,000 a barrel, obviously people can't afford it anymore to some degree. And then therefore you have, you know, the prices drop because of supply requirements and demand. And then, you know, so there's a certain point of equilibrium is what you're saying.
Right. And we saw this in 2008. You had a run-up in oil prices, and a lot of it was due to China's importing before the Olympics were there. And you had U.S. demand was weakening, but at the same time, we still weren't seeing that the recession was going to be as strong as it was, so it didn't fall completely off the map. But as soon as, you know, gas prices hit $4, consumer behavior shifted, and oil prices fell. I mean, it was, demand driven up, demand driven down.
So do you think, I mean, we're about to see $4 of oil. Last time around, though, there was a conglomeration of issues, whether it was the overextension of credit and all that. I mean, there's a much healthier economy now, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, if we hit $4 oil, I mean, it's going to change consumer behavior and what they're going to drive and how they're going to move around. But, I mean, the consumer itself is in a much better state where they are today than they were, 2 years ago.
Now, I think the other thing that's also, I think we all have to admit that back then, there was no precedent, there was no alert system, there was no looking back to recent history and saying, oh, this could happen, and, with the overage of credit, et cetera. And now everybody's much on much higher alert, don't you think?
On credit? Oh, definitely.
Yeah, not only credit, but on economic collapse potential. Everybody's on alert. It just happened 2 years ago, for goodness sakes. So everybody's kind of like, okay, let's watch for the signals and let's not get crazy.
I don't think anybody's on the alert that the oil prices by themselves are going to be a catalyst for a double dip recession or another downturn or weaker economic growth.
Right.
At least I haven't read any of
it
yet.
No, I'm saying big picture. People are, people, when I say people, companies, a company. If I was a president of a big company, I would be much more aware of the potential hazards of some of the various economic circumstances, over leveraging the company, my balance sheets being out of whack, et cetera. I'm just saying, I would be much more aware of it coming from what we saw a couple of years ago.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So anyway, all right, listen, Jeff, your outlook obviously doesn't change a lot from what you're telling me here. You're still seeing a reasonable growth in the future. All the manufacturing seems to be on fire. And by the way, one of the things that I always look at, and I'm sure you do too, is the sales to inventory to sales ratios, and those look pretty good all of a sudden. I mean, they were kind of inching up, and now they just dropped down. Did you notice that?
Yes and no. I mean, you expected this to happen because inventories by themselves were skyrocketing so much that a lot of it was due to just production because you knew demand was going to come, and there was so much pent up demand that eventually, sales had to reach those levels.
Is everybody, just to let you know how Jeff Rosen is a real economist. He never totally agrees with me or disagrees with me. It's somewhere in the middle. It's somewhere, a little. It's kind of like 40% chance of rain. Jeff, you're a great
46.
Guy. Thanks. I appreciate that. Listen, Jeff Rosen from Briefing.com. Again, folks, check out Briefing.com. I mean, they don't pay to or sponsor us or anything like that, but really great stuff. We use a lot of their work and analysis, and Jeff does just a spiffy job at all of his analysis. Jeff Rosen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, now, after we talked about the economy, I thought, as I mentioned, we would talk about the technicals. What's happening with the flavor of the market? What's happening from the investor standpoint, the trends, if you will? And who better than Corey Rosenbloom? He writes the blog AfraidToTrade.com. He does mentoring. He also does a lot of teaching. He's been touring the country at the various money shows, doing a great job. An unbelievable book, which we'll get into in a minute, that you really need to pick up if you want to learn about technical analysis. And on top of that, he also has a bunch of newsletters. So there's a nice big plug for you, Corey. How's that?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
How's the book going? It looks like it's selling pretty well.
It's well. I was in New York at the Expo just recently in February, and I'm getting some initial feedback. The book's not been out that long,
right.
So a lot of people are just starting to finish it at this point, but the feedback has been doing well, and you never know the sales numbers. That comes out later, of course, but I'm pleased so far, definitely.
Yeah. What remind everybody of the exact name and where they can get it?
Sure. It's The Complete Trading Course from Wiley Finance, and it's at Amazon.com or really Borders, Books A Million, anywhere. That's the local bookstore, online sellers too. So it's just a complete trading course.
Right. So when you look around the aisles for investments in Borders, and if they're still available in terms of if they're open, they're going to be closing soon, Borders, I guess. But if you do, you just go look for Horowitz, where my book is, and then probably a shelf or two down is Corey's book on the Rosenbloom for the complete traders course. Okay. So here's the deal, Corey. You and I talk a lot, and we've been talking about levels, and we've been talking about where to. And Corey's big, just folks, just to understand something, Corey looks at probabilities, a lot of if then. So for example, if we see a move to X, on the S&P 500, the likely move from there from a technical standpoint will be Y and then Z. If it breaks down below this level, well, it may go to here, then here. And that's the likely trend that we would see. So I thought that what we do, and Corey talked and I talked about this a couple of days ago, it was, you know, hey, Corey, tell me something. How about we go and kind of come up with some if-then scenarios to talk about what's happening? Because the market looks at right now, while it's in a bullish run, if it were a rally mode, it looks like it's at a kind of a stalling point here, and there's a real question in terms of, on a lot of people's mind, of where does it go from here? So what do you think, Corey?
Well, sure. I just real quick going over the if-then statements, I kind of want to just show the importance of them and how that's used, and how they can be used, just not so much even for technical traders, but for fundamental or longer-term investors.
Right.
Or looking at, before we get to actual what's happening now, just the validity of this method. For example, we spoke recently about the S&P at the main level, mm-hmm. the Fibonacci, nothing complex. The 61.8% retracement was 12 on the S&P. 1228, just to make it even, 1230.
Mm-hmm.
Once you broke above that, the next level to play for was 1300, mm-hmm. and that occurred a few months later. Now, in the S&P, we'll look at the same scenario. So once we broke above 1300, that key level, key inflection point, the next spot to play for, that was the high from 2008. I think it was June or July there. So we hit that target. Now, we're above that target, and we open up the new if-then statement. And if we're above 1,300, then we can look to play for the next technical level. And I believe it was the May high from 2008. That's at 1,450. So that's a little bit higher. As we're going to progress higher in the market, there's an old saying, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. In a bull market, there are no resistance levels, mm-hmm. only support levels. Of course, in a bear market, there are no support levels, only resistance levels. And so that's what's happening in the stock market, really oil and gold for that matter, too. Persistence in uptrends, in terms of the bigger picture, we're seeing the S&P above, and for that matter, Dow and NASDAQ and Russell, above their monthly, weekly, and daily triple moving averages. That's the 20, 50, and 200 period moving averages. We would call that the most bullish orientation possible. So in the sense of those, if that really remains true, which is happening now, there's no upper level. And what we just call these levels for if-thens are for short-term traders to play towards. That's when those who are bullish may take off their positions. Say they hit the target, so they'll go ahead and sell, claim some profits, and maybe get long if it breaks that level. And short sellers may decide to aggressively come in and try to hit the bid or hit the market down. And, of course, if the market breaks that level, they'll take their stop and drive it higher.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the effect, really, of these if-then statements are. They're just inflection points of bull and bears from a technical, simple, nothing complex about it, standpoint. If above a level, bears will cover and they will rush out of the markets. If above a level, bulls will step back into the markets, off the sidelines maybe, and will drive it higher. And the next stopping point can be the higher levels that they play for. It's like a battle, step by step, day by day.
Definitely
one,
a battle.
One battle point. Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
So, you know, a lot of people think that There's a grouping of people out there that think that, hey, you know what? Fundamental analysis is the only way to play. Technical analysis is hocus pocus. It's drawing and all that. But, you know, the fact is that the way that I see it is that, you know how I see it. You have to use both and kind of combine both of those arts and sciences together, part art, part science on each, to develop what is going to be, you know, these points. But the other thing that's important is, that, you know, when you start talking about Fibonacci numbers, people are like, well, wait a minute. You draw these silly numbers on a page and you start out at the low point, you end up at the high point or vice versa, and you have these points, this, you know, certain standard deviations and certain numbers that was developed by this Italian scientist way back when, or mathematician way back when. But here's the thing. I'm sure you would probably agree with this. It's not so much that those particular numbers, whether it's the 60s or the 30s or whatever the number may be on the Fibonacci scale, in terms of what it is anything special, it's other than the fact that a lot of people utilize them and therefore it becomes a reality.
Exactly. Technical analysis, it's somewhat controversial to say this, but you can't convince me otherwise. Technical analysis is self-fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And so people see that, especially in today's highly active markets, when there's all sort of information to get on, you know, free on the internet for that matter. And so people watch these levels, and they will, again, if a level's hit, it becomes self-fulfilling. Those who have positions on will take them off at a level to say, well, maybe it's going to hold in reverse, and so they exit the position. And so others will come in the opposite way and say, this level will hold, and so they short, or whatever the case is, they're buying into a support level. And so if that happens, the market begins to move and inflect in that direction. And so that's the market's moved by supply and demand, not magic numbers.
Right.
So what I look for in my analysis is confluence. I use no method over another one. Fibonacci is not as important as candles or simple trend lines or simple moving averages. It's all the same to me. I'm looking for places of points of confluence where other participants, other large funds, may have their algorithm trading or their levels they're watching.
Right.
If I can tap into that kind of mentality with computer programs will run, that's more important. So, for example, we mentioned the 61.8% retracement of the Fibonacci. It's just big numbers to say 1230. That's all it was. Well, it happened to be the inflection point or the high point in 2010 in April. And, of course, the market turned down from there. And it happened again in, I think it was October or November. The market peaked at that level. We came down, I think it was a 50 or 75 points. And eventually, later in December, broke it. So the level was so important, just for a simple trend line level, 1230. It hit twice, repelled the market events. But once it broke that level, that's all that mattered. It broke that level, and it opened the doorway to play for the higher targets. And that was the prior swing high. Nothing special about that either. From 2008, that was 1300, which is a round number. That's
right.
A key number to look for, too.
And the thing is, it doesn't matter whether you're looking at, well, the S&P 500 has better earnings or the S&P 500 has worse. The fact is, the numbers of where that went to is what market participants are willing to bid it up to or sell it to. And the technical analysis is a graphical representation of what that is. In other words, whether or not there are good fundamentals underlying the market or not, just for the moment, the fact is that the 1300 level where the S&P is right now is where it is. What will happen, because the market is a forward discounting mechanism, meaning that the future of what is going to be is already priced in, or at least that's what people say it is. And what happens there is that you will have certain things happening, whether it's by coincidence or whether it is by tying it all together, of where things will play out. And if you ignore that, for example, there are people that say, hey, the unemployment level is above 8%. How can we have a strong economy or whatever? And you say, well, that being the case, then why is the stock market moving up? On the other hand, you could say, well, oil's at 105, and that should either break the market or the market won't care, whatever it will be. Point is, though, you have to take in consideration the technicals and the trend to what that is telling you, because fighting the trend doesn't get anybody anywhere, right?
Well, no, it doesn't. And it actually opens up the way for positive feedback loops. It's a very powerful concept of supply and demand. Supply and demand move prices, not anything, not fundamentals, not technicals. It's just the participants taking on and putting off positions under conditions of uncertainty. So what happens, let's say if 1300 breaks, which it did recently, we have those that are short into the level that are betting against it, betting the economy will fall, stocks will fall from 1300, the market will peak and turn lower. Once they enter a position short, they typically will cover, if they're wise, above that level. Otherwise, they expose themselves for unlimited loss, and that's something they just can't endure. So They have to take off those positions. And for short sellers to do that, that's bullish. They're buying. That is an area of demand. Well, those that are sidelined, we know a lot of them, we speak to them from time to time, that have said, well, I just cannot get in this market. It's gone too far, too fast, too hard, and it needs to pull back. What it keeps breaking 1,100, 1,200, 1,300. Eventually, they say, I can't take this sideline. I'm going to rush in. So it is self-fulfilling, but it becomes also a positive feedback loop where higher prices cause bears to buy, which also causes bulls to come in for whatever reason. It could be fear, greed. It doesn't matter. The fundamentals, just psychology.
Now, but Corey, would you also agree that last point that you made about people who can't take it anymore and finally get in, particularly on the retail side, when that happens, that is a cause of concern?
A cause of concern in terms of sentiment?
Yeah.
In terms of when there's new... Well, that's an old... It's an old argument. It's valid. But at the same time, a lot of people are kind of off the sidelines. There was net outflows from mutual funds for months and months and months.
Right.
And now we're seeing in 2011, they're coming off the sidelines. So The old argument would say, when everybody turns bullish, there's no one left to buy the market. There's no more demand left to push the market higher. That's a good logic, but it's just as it keeps on progressing higher, that logic continues and more people come in. So the markets cannot rise forever. Trends do reverse, But as we're moving from level to level, breaking resistance, breaking resistance, breaking resistance, becomes a point of no return.
Right.
Until you break lower levels,
right.
This market is not a short.
So let's talk about some of the things that we're seeing here. One of the things that we've been constantly hearing is first of all, from all the pundits, which, by the way, I don't necessarily agree with this philosophy, is buy the dips. Now, they will work for some time. The concept of buying dips, selling rips, will work. But the problem is that when it doesn't work is when things get a little bit ugly, whenever that is. And that will be bound to happen eventually. Once, twice, whatever. You know, once burned, okay. Twice burned, everybody starts getting a little bit nervous about that, whether you're on the short side or on the long side. But when you look at this market and you see that it has a pretty good backstop, you know, we did break down a little bit below the the Dow broke below 12,000. We also saw the S&P break down below 1,300. We saw the Russell break down below 800 for, I don't know, a day, and then it closed up. It didn't actually close above it. Closed below it, but they closed above all those numbers. We're seeing bullish sentiment, and we're seeing this buy the dip, and any kind of dip becomes a buyable event, right?
Well, that's what's happening in terms of the psychology. What I'm seeing in terms of the market underscoring principles now, it's the QE2 is driving this.
Mm.
What's happening, this is a broader concept of a narrative. It kind of pulls away from tentacles, but then at the same time, it reinforces them. The Federal Reserve is stimulating with accommodative monetary policy. Basically, they're injecting liquidity into a recovering economy. So this was not the case in 2009 when the market was actually falling off an abyss. The Fed began to boost the market with liquidity, and there were bailouts, there was two rounds of stimulus, etc., and that helped things. The economy was suffering at that time. Now we have an economy that is actually recovering. And you, from a fundamental standpoint, would agree with that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
The economy is recovering, so that's bullish in itself, and the Fed is being accommodative. So it's increasing liquidity, keeping rates at zero, et cetera. So it's really almost like the Fed started the fire back in 2009, and now they're adding lighter fluid to a fire. So in that sense, you almost have to overrule a sentiment or whatever. So because the prices are going up, but the economy is recovering, that's bullish for stocks. Liquidity is coming into the system. The Fed is doing the QE2. That's also bullish for stocks. So really, again, in a bull market, as long as those forces continue, there is no resistance.
You know, one of the things that we've talked about is the incredible amount of liquidity that the Fed has pumped in. And whether or not you agree with that, because you have to question, when is that all going to be repaid? How is that going to be repaid? How much inflation is that going to cause? That's a different discussion entirely. But the Fed is putting an unprecedented amount of upward pressure on the economics, because they're doing their best to keep rates low, helping out the banks, and therefore, in a way, providing a backstop. It's not as apparent as what happened in Saudi Arabia this weekend, where there was a direct injection. Was Saudi Arabia? Let me think about this for a second. Saudi Arabia. It was Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia decided to put a direct injection by buying shares of the stocks on the exchange as a show of support, because the markets had dropped about 15 or 18% over the last several weeks, and the market popped 7% in one day.
Right.
You know, talk about, you know, it's one thing doing this kind of Bernanke move where you're overtly helping the markets. It's another thing entirely by actually putting money in by buying shares. I mean, that's almost to a point of you got to scratch your head and you got to wonder, you know, what's that about?
Well, Japan is that same thing too. I'm not sure recently, but a few months ago, we're engaging in quantitative easing of the treasuries. It's just a long-winded approach to the market. The Federal Reserve is buying treasury bonds, essentially printing electronic dollars to do so, which is stimulative. But the Bank of Japan, I was not aware of that, but Saudi Arabia, if that report is true as well, they're essentially purchasing equities with treasuries.
Right.
That's a whole
right.
other Pandora's box, but it's not just that the European Central Bank, we have Brazil, et cetera. They're stimulating economies. And so it's a global, we keep talking about the QE2. This is a global phenomenon of injection of, that's probably liquidity is a better word. It's an injection of liquidity into the global system, which is, again, causing inflation. We're seeing oil rise as a consequence. And maybe it's not a consequence if you're long these things, but or gold, et cetera. But if you are an average citizen, it becomes a consequence.
Right.
The price of everything that's going to go up.
Right.
Gold, new highs, silver, etc.
So, you know, I looked at, I'm sorry, but did you look at the commitment of traders this week for oil?
Not for oil. I look at it for the stocks.
And how's that looking? What does that look like?
Let's see, right now we're having, it's almost bullish. With the COT, the commitment of traders logic, is it's breaking down the commitment, the traders into three different groups. Those are professional, have a certain large, they have a certain criteria, a certain position they have to report. And so that's done weekly. Otherwise, we have hedgers. Those have to report too, not so much in stocks, but in terms of oil or cocoa. Those are a little bit more, you know, they're Nestle, the ones that actually use the cocoa or use the oil, and the ones that produce it. So that's a separate issue. We don't have that in stocks, a little bit more nebulous. And the retail, those that participate in the futures market that hold them long or hold contracts, but don't meet that threshold. They're considered retail.
Right.
What we have now, and by the way, that's been really, really a good indicator from really the 2007 peak to the bottom. But what we're looking at in terms of that logic is break it out in stocks, where the retail typically, it's you know, bad to say, but usually the retail is on the wrong side of a move ahead of a market turn, and the professionals are on the right side of a move. So as we speak now, it looks like the professionals are net long, about 56,000 ES contracts in the ES futures, and the retail are short about 85,000.
Wow.
So as we're making new highs in the market, the professionals have gotten more long, have increased their long net positions, and the retail have actually begun declining week over week over week over week, and they're net short. And that's, we have to interpret that as bullish.
Right, right. So, yeah, oil, I looked at the commitment of traders on the oil side, and it's like a spike up off the charts, and you would expect that. And that's, again, for the commodity trading and futures trading. So that was, you know, what we've seen is far past the, I think, 2008 peak of what the commitment of traders were in the holdings of oil back then. So, you know, two things can happen there, right? So you either see the continuation of this or a major breakdown, as we saw when people start unwinding their long commitments and the long the bets that things will go up. But right now, there is still that substantial amount of long positions on oil. So that kind of makes you a little bit, I think, a little bit nervous. At least it makes me nervous in the fact that, you know, we're seeing a very big change of sentiment when it comes to the dollar. You know, even on good news, the dollar is being sold, generally speaking, even on good news for the U.S. economy, which should push it up. And then at the same time, the safety trade, or the historical safety trade, which has been that when there is a world event of some sort or catastrophe or something that spooks the world markets, people would oftentimes run to the dollar as a safety play. And that's not happening anymore.
No, it's not. What's happening, too, in terms of the market, at least in the intermarket bigger picture, the QE2 and other things, too, we looked for the dollar to be on one side of the equation, and then the S&P, which are stocks, oil and gold, and of course commodities, silver, copper, etc., to be on the opposite side. So what the three of them go up in terms of the positive correlations in stocks, which say gold and oil, and that would mean the dollar would go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening now, at least what we call exogenous shocks, these little surprise moves out of the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
political uncertainty, really governments being overthrown, these are severe consequences in terms of the populations and also to oil production. Supply routes. We were worried about the Suez Canal coming under, you know, siege or something. So what's happening now is oil, these events are breaking the back of intermarket technical analysis. You're having oil and gold benefit from the QE2, the liquidity injection globally, and you're having these little surprise news events benefit them as well from a shock standpoint. But that breaks the relationship because the stock market doesn't like that. It spooks the investors and sends them over to safety, where
mm-hmm.
gold becomes a hedge really for inflation. And the dollar typically is going to be inverse that too. So it's moving opposite stocks. So you're breaking this little relationship. So, yeah, and the dollar just broke recent support levels at 77 on the index. So we're looking at that from a bearish standpoint as the oil, gold, not so much stocks at the second we're talking now, but that may happen soon if it breaks up to new highs. Those are breaking out to new highs. And dollar breaking down, so unless there's any kind of reversal in this, I guess, position, these things probably should continue.
Yeah. So also, I want to talk about two things and then get back to some of the levels and get some key levels that people can write down and can, you know, put down for themselves. But the VIX has been all over the place, recently up dramatically compared to where it was. It was about 15, 16 a couple of weeks back, and then it spiked up to about, what, 22 and a half or so, 23 right. or so, and then it came back a little bit. But still, it's over 19 and approaching on 20. I mean, what is that telling you? Anything at all?
Sort of. I did a post, actually, glad you mentioned this. I did a post, I think it was last week, talking about the VIX and the simple, and no thrills to it, the 200-day simple moving average. And that's just a level that people that are investors, that just, they're going to look at that and determine a market in an uptrend, downtrend, or just a simple technical definition. Multiple times over the last 2 years, and I don't have the post in front of me, but just off of memory, the VIX would spike above. This happened, I think, in March, the flash crash in April, May. It broke the 200-day moving average, and from that point on, supported on it. And then once it broke it again, once the market was back, I think it was August or September, we're back in a more neutral, bullish, and things are okay now.
Mm-hmm.
The VIX actually would rally up to the 200-day SMA and would come down off of it. Well, that's what happened recently. I believe it rallied up to the end of February, but the 2250 or 23 level did not close above the 200-day simple moving average and then turn right back down.
Right.
So if you're looking at the VIX in terms of a what next or whatever, in terms of the if-thens, I would say if you break the 200-day moving average, close strongly above it, that's about 2250, I think, now, that's a significant turning point, similar to what we would see back in April, May of 2010. And unless that happens, then volatility, we can say, is contained. Yes, it picked up, but it never broke that key level. And so until that level breaks, we would have to assume the trend of sideways or low volatility would continue. And if that happens, that's bullish for stocks.
Right. In some of our portfolios, we actually entered about 2 weeks ago the VIX call, the April 19s. And for our trading portfolios, the TDI Managed Growth, we did that. And then we sold it. The VIX spiked so quickly, and frankly, we were just lucky to get it on that day. We weren't expecting that kind of move. I mean, it went up 110 or 20%. We made in a matter of 3 days. And then we closed the position. It dropped back down about 50%. And then we opened up a new position in the 2250s just because of that, by the way. We have the April 2250 calls.
You and I discussed that by email, if not by phone. I was mentioning, it was almost teasing, that volatility being, this is before the market picked up volatility, when VIX has just been crushed for so long. I think I joked, go ahead and buy a call. There's no way you can lose money off this. Buy 3 months in advance. Right. There will be some kind of spike. We don't know when or what's going to cause it, but the VIX just can't stay at 16 forever. Once it spikes up, kill the position, you have a profit. And that's exactly what you did. So yep. That's how it works.
It's right now, you know, I think it's one of the better ways to play the volatility, or at least to protect your portfolio, even though it has some downside characteristics where it has a short life expectancy, obviously, and anything can happen. But the fact is that, you know, with that, you know what you're possibly going to lose. You can still have your portfolio invested in a way and have some protection, because if it does, in fact, move up, you're going to get a big bang for your buck on that particular type of investment. We only have a small position because we don't want to have the degradation of the decay of the time value of it, of course. But, you know, it does help with the volatility on a daily basis to kind of cool down any kind of major risk. And as we do see oil at this high, they're not going to really sell off the VIX until we see resolution of the situation, at least as we see it.
I agree. And also, just in terms of just going back to the VIX, in terms of portfolio, the VIX, you have these surprises and shocks that come out of nowhere. And the VIX responds quickly, instantly, with overnight gaps. There's no way to predict what's going to happen next. But
right.
You can hold these levels, and the VIX will stay, you know, stable until these things happen. And just talking to any kind of option trader, any kind of market, volatility is far easier to predict than directionality. In directionality, it's up and down, or sideways for that matter. But if the VIX, in terms of volatility, the volatility of the market in general will cycle between high volatility and low volatility. So it's really a good, easier to predict. A low volatility environment will eventually, at some point, hopefully soon, erupt into a high volatility environment, which will then cool down and wind down to equilibrium and decline in volatility. And directionality is more complicated than that, but cyclicality and volatility is, I think, easier. So yeah, it works as a very good hedge in a portfolio.
Right. So let's go back. Let's wind it back here, and we'll bring to the closing of this discussion about what are the levels. And folks, what I want you to do is just jot these numbers down as information to take a look at when you're looking at a chart of the various markets, and to look at as guides to say, hey, maybe, you know, I am going to think about being long or short or whatever your position is until maybe this happens. And look at what happens, whether you're going to actually trade this or whether you're going to actually use this as a learning exercise. Put these down so you can mark them, and whether you use a trading system, like a charting system or whatever, just, you know, or just print the chart off of Yahoo or Google and just draw these lines in and see how that plays out. Put some alerts out there on the various alerts that you have in some of the software. So let's start with the S&P 500, Corey. Okay, let's go through that again. So we know you said that the upside right now is breaking out towards what's the next level from here?
Sure. Right now we're sitting above 1300, and mm-hmm. the larger picture, intermediate term gameplay is if we're above 1300. Then we can expect a move to the prior swing high from, I believe it was May 2008. That's 1450, I think 1440 to be exact, but I like to keep it in terms of round numbers. So as long as we're above 1300, the if then in the larger picture becomes 1450. Now, we've hit a high at 1350 recently in February, so I would say now, in terms of if you're not positioned already, a breakout to new highs in the S&P beyond 1350 should reconfirm, or would reconfirm, that target to the higher level, 1450. And of course, simple if-thens, if above 1450, the next level is off to new highs in the S&P.
Mm. So let's just restate this very simply. So right now, the if-then really is, the one we want to look at, is if, not above 1300 really, but if above, right, 1350, because that's your confirmation point, if above, correct, 1350, then, which is a wide point from there, the next stop is 1450. And then, of course, you'll have intermediate points in between there once that, and if that happens.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so downside.
That's the upside. The downside would be, that's with the trend. We always want to go in technical analysis with the trend. So mm-hmm. That's the lower, or the higher probability expected play. The alternate, now always have alternates. Never just say, it's going to go up, I'm going to be long, and I'll never close my position. Always, that's what the if-thens right. are. So if the if-thens on the downside become, we're looking at 1300, but I would say a more important level than that is going to be 1280, because that would break your 50-day moving average, mm-hmm. which has not happened since September. That's a key level in terms of a short-term trend. So, and we're also would break a swing low from January. So under 1280 in the S&P 500 would open up a pathway to play down to the November low at 1180, if not 1200, which is our 200-day moving average. So for a short-term trader, I would protect myself, or even an investor, I would protect myself on a move under 1280 in the S&P. But until then, it's the market has to prove
right.
that the trend is reversed and is in trouble, because we're fighting a trend to short it here. If under 1280, look for a potential move to 1200, if not 1180.
Okay, and what other indices that we have to look? Because that's a main index, obviously, that we want to look at.
Right.
What other things you have?
In terms of the S&P?
Nope, in terms of...
Oh, okay. The cross-market analysis, gold. Definitely. I'm looking at the bigger picture in terms of how these play together. Remember, now with the exception of these shocks, these scary things in the Middle East, gold, oil, and stocks tend to move together. So we'll move to gold at this point. And gold, let me flip the chart real quick. So what we're looking at in gold, we have just breached to a new high, and that broke above 1430, right? That was the 2010 area. So the play in gold is just bullish. It benefits from global liquidity. It benefits from economic uncertainty. So gold really has no upper resistance, and it broke those levels, did not stay above them. And that's a little bit interesting. It's a little bit of a non-confirmation. So the if then simply becomes, if you are above 1440, if not 1450 in gold, then you will open up a pathway to, there's no number.
Yeah, there's no number there.
You can't look backward, right? You can look backward in stocks. You can't look back in gold.
Well, but you could do a Fibonacci projection on that, right?
Sure, absolutely. You can do any kind of, like, that's more complex, but I would just say I like round numbers. Once you're above those levels, you're not asking when do I enter, you're asking when do I take profit,
mm-hmm.
or what levels, et cetera. So you're going to hold on until you get those levels. So simple, 1500, I would say a couple of target now. A little bit of advanced things I went to, it's about 1550 would be the next target, I would say, with its logical above 1450. If not that, 1600. I think Goldman Sachs and a few others have actual targets from fundamental analysis to 1600, correct?
Yeah, I mean, but you can't have fundamental analysis. That's just ridiculous. How do you quantify fear? How do you quantify, you know, how much money is going to be pumped into the system? How do you quantify, you know, the lack of respect for the dollar? I mean, I can't see it. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of more of a, I would say not so much off the record, because on the record here, but I don't see how gold goes down, with the exception of, you know, look, I call gold kind of Goldilocks. If economic conditions go a little bit sour, people get scared, or inflation concerns rare up, which is crystal clear that's happening, whether, you know, Bernanke says that or not, right? Inflation is becoming a concern. Gold is going to go up. If stocks go down just a little bit, or if global economic uncertainty goes up, then gold will go up too. The only way I see gold going severely down, and this could be a possibility, is if the economy really begins to melt down. And we only saw gold go down severely in 2008 at the heart of the crisis. So to be bearish gold right now is quite dangerous, I think. But those are the upside levels. The downside levels for caution would be 1,400, simple, you know, no special level there. Beyond that would be a break under 1,400 will target, though I think it was the January low at about 1,320. Let's make it 1,300. That's your 200-day moving average. So we have a confluence of different, and there's other time frame areas there too, and a simple level. So I would say if under 1,400, we may see a play back to 1,300. Under 1,300, we begin to open up a little bit of a different scenario. Gold should probably not be under 1,300 if it is, something else is going on. Otherwise, we have a lot of bullish forces with gold that should continue to propel it higher. So if we get to say in a breakout beyond 1,450, I would almost say unlimited upside target.
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, the thing that would actually, in my opinion, break gold, and we've been in and out of gold, and I don't know, you know, it's been a little bit volatile, and obviously took a big snapback recently. You know, you have to wonder though if a quality situation does arise in terms of economics and a global situation where everything calms down. You know, I don't know, and that would be bullish for stocks, and that would be, you know, bullish for equities around the world. I just don't know why people would want to be in gold. I understand the point that they may move in sync with some other equity assets and high risk assets, but on the other hand, I think the big issue for gold, if this is the thing that I think that could really break it, I'm not saying it's going to, but what could happen is if there's a global demand for liquidity. That would be the big issue, because that's where people will pull out. And don't forget, there's one other issue that has really played very big into the gold move, and that's the recent, very recent, last number of years, advent of gold ETFs. You didn't have that opportunity before, and the other ETF, the other three-letter word, which is ATM. There are actually ATMs where you can go get gold, mini gold bullion. That is true. You know that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I find that funny, but yeah, you can definitely do that.
Right. So the thing is that, you know, before you had to buy coins, I mean, I have some gold pandas from the 80s, and, you know, but it was much more difficult to get your hands on gold. Now it's very easy, and that sets up two things, right? It sets up the ease of buying, but also sets up the ease of selling.
That's correct.
So if there is a liquidity desire and people are saying, hey, you know what, I don't want the gold because I want to have my cash. I want to have my ability to liquidate very easily and have it there kind of under the mattress concept, then gold could have a big problem. And the other thing is if we see a situation where inflation is in check, but I agree with you, you know, all these things, there's more than just an if then in all of this. There's the government intervention is in my opinion, the primary cause for everybody's concern and for inflation and all the other things, which is a backlog of issues that go into why gold and silver are doing well. So anyway,
exactly.
You have oil as well? Do you have projections on oil?
Sure. Now, oil, I want to bring this up too, because this is a perfect example of the if-thens. In the reports for weeks, the weekly intermarket analysis reports that I do, we've been looking at 92.50 in terms of the overhead resistance. It was a 50% Fibonacci. You take the bottom in oil in 2000. You know, the top in 2008, the bottom in 2009, the 50% retracement, that was 92.50. We hit that level multiple times. Simple. If you broke above 92.50, the next level to play for was $105. That was your 61.8%.
Which is exactly where it hit Friday.
It's exactly where it hit. And that to me, honestly, this is why I love technical analysis. Because you don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows the future. But of course, the if then was if you come down off 92, we're going to play for lower levels. But we did not. Once we broke 92.50, and I said 93 is an actual target, We hit that in 2 weeks, hit that level, the Fibonacci target, and they get that positive feedback loop. The fear, anybody who was short oil had to come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the side, there's a lot of different buying pressure projected us or propelled us, probably is a better word, to our upside target where we sit as we're having this conversation. So now, as we're at 105, the Fibonacci kind of ends at 61.8 for most people. There's a 71.8%, 78.6. That's at $120 per barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's maybe the next level, 125. Otherwise, oil, if you look at it from the last couple of years, it has hit and paused at round numbers in the tens. So we're looking simply at 110, 120, and then your Fibonacci advanced level comes in at 125. If we can't get above 105, we're obviously looking to play down to 100. If oil goes under 100, it's a non-confirmation, a kind of a trap sign that may open it, well, would open the door to play for the 92.50 level to test it, to test the breakout.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're in a very similar situation right now to, not exactly, but similar situation to where oil was last time that it went this kind of route and where it could spike up dramatically. Because you do have the short sellers out there and you have the players out there that did some hedging and all. And, you know, a lot of hedging has to come in. And there's also players that will come in and work the whole issue. The only difference is right now that the CTFC is big into, or CFTC is big into, or maybe CTFC, Commodity Future. No, CFTC, Commodity Future Trading Commission, is big into right now, you know, putting on margin requirements and as, especially in the soft and the food commodity space, you know, what's happening is that we are seeing this demand rise for a lot of different reasons. We have emerging markets, we have all this, but we also have the shock situation in the Middle East. And this can go either way, because I think there is a possibility and a good possibility that if we see any further spreading of this Middle East contagion, a crisis, you know, overhaul, coup, whatever you want to call it, throughout the region, that oil will spike up, and I agree about the 120-125 range. But then, eventually, what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of unwinding of positions, and we could see a very quick drop. It may not be, you know, 1 month, 2 months, but when the thing starts leveling off, and eventually, if the crisis does abate, then you may see a very precipitous drop in oil.
Yeah, what goes up comes down.
Yep.
Absolutely. We had an absolutely disastrous drop in 2008. It was June or May or July there. It peaked in just, 148, and then collapsed.
Yep.
That was stellar in the technical community. That was amazing.
Yep, I hear you. Well, Corey Rosenblum, we have a lot to chew on here. We have a lot of numbers. I don't know if you have some of these charts you want to send over. We'll put it with the podcast show notes. And we'll make sure that people get over to your site, because you have lots of great things to share. And I do encourage everybody, if you're looking to learn about technical analysis, and you've always kind of been really fascinated about the charts and what it's all about, Corey does offer a great mentoring program where he goes one-on-one with you and can customize a program so you can actually learn and teach. He'll teach you and do live kind of simulations also about, you know, targeting and the things that we're talking about today about various retracement levels as well as trends and all that in between. You also have some great intermarket newsletters that are available, so I would really encourage you to go over to afraidtotrade.com, pick up his book. Great resource, and I thank you for joining us today, buddy.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 202. We're working on getting John Perkins back on in April. We had a conversation with his group last week. We have Jim Rogers. One of these days, we're going to get him on. I know that we're having some difficulty with some scheduling there as well. We're going to have some option talk with John Najarian coming up as well, and a whole host of other things. Of course, we'll answer your questions at any time if you have some. Just send them off to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, I wish you well. Make sure to do me a favor and go over to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's also an iPhone and a mobile edition there, too, if you want to check it out that way, or if your iPad, etc. And click on the Jason Taylor link to do a quick donation. And again, any amount is really appreciated. Whatever it is great. I really thank you for that. I'll see you next week. Have a very successful and a profitable week ahead. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.